It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations! Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
Killer Cross is coming to House of Glory October 10th. There's a killer in the house. For all the people shouting, work, it's a work, not a work. Not that that's going to convince them, but all I can say is, not a work. His three shirts also finally went up on clearance this week on WWE Shop, if you want to get them for half off. I guess that's also a part of the work. Matt and Jeff Hardy are also returning to House of Glory that night. And we've already announced Amazing Red against Leon Slater, the TNA X Division champion. So that is shaping up to be one hell of a night. But you know what was also one hell of a night? August 22nd, 2015. That was the first NXT TakeOver show from Brooklyn. I was there for that one where Bayley beat Sasha Banks to win the NXT Women's Championship. Still my favorite women's match of all time. For me, it's in that 92 Rumble category where there may technically be better matches, but it just will never be topped. Just from the story going into it, to the match itself, to how influential that match has become. You know, Indy Hartwell has said that she signed up for wrestling school the day after watching that match. Like, that's the match that made her want to become a pro wrestler. Billy Starks has said that she watched that match and thought, hey, that's what I'm going to do one day. And I'm sure there are others who are wrestling right now that may not be, were it not for that match. That was 10 years ago this week. And now Sasha's got 9 belts and Bayley is talking to the voices in her head. This is episode 926 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Saturday, August 23rd, 2025. A day early, but never a dollar short. AEW has Forbidden Door tomorrow afternoon. They are encroaching on my territory, so we're doing this a day early, as we will again next weekend, because next Sunday is Clash in Paris, and I will have predictions for Clash in Paris on the show today, and Forbidden Door as well. There's been a few changes, and I've got a medical update as well on Will Ospreay, as well as news on Chris Jericho potentially returning to WWE. The WWE ESPN deal is taking effect a lot earlier than originally expected. I'll get into that. And the story around Hulk Hogan's death just took a very dark turn this week. Be aware that the Raw post shows for the next couple of weeks are going to be at 8 p.m. Eastern. Raw is airing earlier on Netflix for everyone this Monday, 3 o'clock Eastern time. No VPN needed for that. The following Monday, they're in Paris. I don't know if it's airing earlier in the U.S. for everyone. Or if you will need your trusty VPN if you want to watch it early, but it will probably be on international Netflix. And if it is airing there and not earlier in the U.S., that's what I'll be doing. I'll be watching it earlier and then going live at 8 p.m. that night. So that way, you know, I can wrap up a little bit earlier. But also, you know, one of the reasons I do this is I can maybe get some of my international fans in on the streams where normally they might not be able to join because I start so late. So I hear from people saying, oh, I love it when you do the earlier streams because now I can actually join. So it's an opportunity to wrangle some of those people in. So just bear with me in the next week or so because things are going to settle back into a normal schedule after that and we'll be back to the usual times. If you would like to make a PayPal donation to support the show, you may do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. Get them on in earlier again next week since I'm going to be recording a day early, so just be aware of that. But I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. I think Paul was in the YouTube chat on Friday night. I think I spied Paul in there. Big B, Bryant Becerra, thank you. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. I know for a fact that I saw Harrison in the chat the other night. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Fast Blast, Tim Banks, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, The Laredo kid, Alberto Ortiz, who has been listening since 2016 and celebrated his 31st birthday last Tuesday. So happy birthday, Alberto. Dashing David Brown, who wants to give a special shout out to his friends Martin, Craig, Ryan, and Patrick. They're back in London for Forbidden Door after a fun night of Dynamite and Collision in Glasgow this week. Says, I hope you, the listeners, and the Facebook group members enjoy Forbidden Door as much as we will live at the O2. Should be rocking. Going to have a sold-out crowd inside the O2, all those crazy UK fans. Thank you, David. And happy birthday, not to Vince McMahon, who turns 80 years old tomorrow, but to Marlon from Texas, who was born way back in the wonderful year of 1988. Says, I've been listening to your podcast since 2012 and got me through a lot of long nights working at CVS, where to this day I have listened to some of the funniest episodes, the Martha Stewart Hanging with Mr. Cooper one and the Vince McMahon Pastry Shop one. Ah, yes. Yes, yes, yes. That was the Mr. McMahon's Pastry Palace intro from Sound Off episode 367. One of my favorites. Happy birthday, Marlon. I also want to take a moment here to send my condolences on behalf of the entire Sound Off family to my friend and my Tuesday Night Titans co-host, JD from New York, who lost his grandmother on Wednesday. We had talked about what was going on the day before, and it's never easy to lose a family member, especially your parents or your grandparents. Yeah, I was very close with my grandma, and she died 25 years ago, a quarter of a damn century. I haven't had a grandparent in my life for 25 years. You know, my parents are gone. So it doesn't get better. It never gets better. It only gets easier to deal with as time goes on. You know, but that hurt is always there. So I'm thinking about you, my friend. Having just announced their new media rights deal with ESPN for their PLE starting in 2026, WWE at ESPN went and decided, you know what? Why wait until next year? Why not just start next month? That was the big news this week. Not only did the new ESPN streaming service officially launch on Thursday, but the Peacock era is coming to an end with Clash in Paris at the end of this month, at least when it comes to main roster PLEs. NXT PLEs will continue airing on Peacock as planned. That's through March of 2026. In fact, NXT has one airing tomorrow night, Heatwave. You notice how they don't even brand them as NXT events anymore? It's just WWE now. WWE Heatwave. So this means that all main roster PLEs will be airing in the U.S. exclusively on ESPN's new direct-to-consumer service, starting with a brand new PLE being added to the schedule on Saturday, September 20th. It's going to be running opposite AEW All Out. This was just a rumor last week, but it's all confirmed now. It will be WWE Wrestlepalooza, kicking off the ESPN era. So the WrestleVotes report proved to be accurate. Wrestlepalooza was the name of an old ECW pay-per-view that ran from 1995 to 2000, which plays off the name of the popular Lollapalooza music festival that started in 1991 and runs out of Chicago to this very day. In fact, it just concluded a few weeks ago. And yes, to those who have asked, it was also the name of the wrestling event where Bud Bundy had to wrestle King Kong Bundy to get initiated into the No Man group on an episode of Married with Children. That episode actually aired in October of 1995. The first ECW Wrestlepalooza took place in August of that year. If you want to be technical about it, ECW did it first. But look, it could always be worse. They could do a show called Great Balls of Fire. I mean, I know that would never happen, right? Because that would be awful. Why the Wrestlepalooza name? Especially when there was an independent promotion that was using the name and had trademarked it for the last decade. Why go through the hassle? Why go through the trouble of buying it away from them? Well, Tony Khan is an admitted mark for the old ECW, and they're running this show directly opposite the All Out pay-per-view. So it sure feels like someone in Stamford thought, hey, let's drive the knife even deeper and use an old ECW name just to rub salt in the wound. Because WWE would never be that petty. I mean, come on now, right? I mean, they wouldn't be that petty, would they? No, never. Of course not. So the show will take place at the Gainbridge Fieldhouse in Indianapolis, which means that Pat McAfee will be there, at least for one night. You know, him being an indie guy and all. Not that kind of indie guy, but you know what I mean. ESPN will also carry the two remaining PLEs for the year after that, which are Crown Jewel in October and Survivor Series in November. If you live outside the U.S., nothing changes for you. The shows will continue to air on Netflix internationally, so you don't have to worry about any of this. ESPN did not buy out Peacock's remaining rights. What happened is WWE worked things out with Peacock and then brought it to ESPN for approval. Because WWE felt that by splitting WrestleMania and SummerSlam into two nights over the last few years, and then adding the Evolution show last month, that they had already fulfilled their commitment to Peacock for whatever the number of shows was that they were contracted for. And that's very interesting that that would seem to imply that they only added the Evolution show because they knew that this deal with ESPN was in the works. So by adding it, and, you know, adding it the same weekend as AEW All In, that was just a little added bonus for them. But by adding that show to the calendar, they were able to speed things up so they could get the hell off Peacock that much quicker. Which is very interesting. I mean, look, there's any number of reasons that you could look at for why they did Evolution after not doing another one for 7 or 8 years. But anybody who thinks that they just decided, hey, you know what, we really got to do another Evolution show now because, boy, the women are killing it, and we just got to do one of these. Like, I'm always looking for some ulterior motive, and I think we just found it. I think we just found what the ulterior motive was for them doing that show when they did. But as part of the deal that WWE worked out with them, Peacock will be getting new main roster programming, details of which will be revealed soon. Right now, we don't know what that means. So, I mean, that doesn't sound like documentaries, right? If they're talking about main roster programming. I mean, the last thing we need is more shows. So I'm curious what that ends up being. Now, for his part, on the Forbidden Door media call on Thursday, Tony Khan was asked about WWE running so many shows head-to-head with AEW. And he gave a very smart, very disciplined answer by not even addressing them and instead saying that their focus is on AEW and continuing what he called their excellent year in 2025. And again, whether you agree with that statement or not is completely irrelevant. I thought that was exactly the answer that he should have given. That's all he needs to do is just focus on AEW and making it the best that it can possibly be. And when asked about what Mark Shapiro of TKO said, that pay-per-view was dead, you know, it's a dead business, Tony said their pay-per-views this year have been successful and that he's looking forward to adding them to HBO Max. Now, they've been talking about AEW pay-per-views on HBO Max for almost a year now, and they have provided no updates on where things are as far as that's concerned. I have no idea what is taking so long or why it would be so difficult for Warner to have the infrastructure in place by now to support this. That's not even a Tony Khan issue or an AEW issue. They're basically at the mercy of Warner Brothers Discovery and HBO Max. Once they get their shit together, you know, they can shift their pay-per-views over to HBO Max. But we've heard nothing new, and it's been almost a year. But WWE is going to load up that WrestlePalooza show. You know, Brock Lesnar is likely going to wrestle his first match back on that show against John Cena. He's already been scheduled for SmackDown on September 12th and September 19th. That leads right into the show on September 20th. I'm thinking Cody Rhodes defends the WWE Championship that night against Drew McIntyre. All Out will probably have Copeland and Christian challenging for the AEW Tag Team titles. I could see Jon Moxley against Darby Allin. We don't know what Hangman Page or MJF are going to be doing. You know, the rest of the card is anyone's guess. But All Out is typically one of their bigger shows of the year. And I'm sure that Tony will load it up regardless. It will be the better wrestling show of the night. I have no doubt about that. But WWE is not trying to out-wrestle AEW. They're not trying to have the better matches that night. I mean, if they do, that's great. But that they're not doing it to dominate, you know, the wrestling ratings, you know, the star ratings. They're doing it to dominate the conversation and steal all the headlines and around Brock Lesnar's first match back alone. I mean, for better or worse, they're going to be stealing all the headlines that weekend. What I'll be doing that night, I haven't decided yet. You know, head-to-head is going to screw up my recording schedule that weekend regardless. But I'm going to review the show live that I think more people are going to be tuning in for. You know, let's see how the cards shape up first, and then we'll decide. I did put an early poll up on Twitter to gauge people's interest without knowing the cards yet, still very early, but just to gauge their interest on which show they plan on watching live that night. And WrestlePalooza won the vote, 58% to 42%. And that's with over 3,200 votes in. So that's a clear win for WWE, but not exactly a landslide. So let's see how the cards shape up. I mean, I don't even have free access to the ESPN service since they decided to launch this shit early. They still have no agreement with YouTube TV. So I may have to use my trusty ExpressVPN and watch it on Netflix until they do. I mean, yeah, look, I could pay the $29.99 a month. You know, until they reach an agreement, it's not that big of a deal, but it's the principle of it. Like, just knowing that most people are probably watching this shit for free, you know, because they have ESPN and they have a service that offers ESPN, so then you can get the service for free. And just knowing that most people are watching this shit for free, and I have to pay $30 to watch Brock Lesnar against John Cena, I feel like I'm being punished. Do I want to spend $30 to watch John Cena against Brock Lesnar? Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. Now, that wasn't the only news to come out of this. If you think WWE is getting out of the Peacock business and Peacock is getting out of the WWE business, think again. This week, the two sides announced a multi-year partnership to become the exclusive streaming home for Saturday night's main event, which will air live on Peacock four times a year through, I believe, 2029. Which is when the NBC Universal deal for SmackDown expires. And even though there's already been three of them this year, we had a Saturday night's main event in January. We had one in May. We had one in July. So you would think there's only one left. But despite that, there are two more. With the first one taking place on November 1st from Salt Lake City, Utah. And the second one and final one of the year taking place on December 13th. And that will likely be in Boston. That will be the night of John Cena's retirement match. I don't think they've confirmed Boston yet as the location, but they have confirmed in the press release that will be John Cena's final match. No one is happier to hear that news than Tony Khan, because World's End is spared. There was talk of them maybe doing the show on December 27th, which is the night of AEW World's End on pay-per-view, so Tony is relieved right now. Bill Goldberg, on the other hand, he may be throwing furniture around somewhere and probably injuring himself that John Cena will get to do his retirement on Peacock with no commercials like he had on NBC. And that's why I really like that decision. I mean, does it lose a little bit of luster by not airing live on NBC? Sure. But if it means fewer commercials and ad breaks mid-match, that instantly makes the show better. So I'm fine with that. But it also shows that NBC was not exactly thrilled with how the shows were performing, because if they were, there's no way that they would have taken them off NBC, at least not for John Cena's retirement match. You know, at least for that one, they would at least be simulcasting that shit, and they're not. And I think that's very telling. And also, you know, since they're losing the main roster PLEs, you know, they want to do what they can to keep people subscribed to Peacock. So how do you do that? You've got to offer them something exclusive that they can't get anywhere else. You know, by making the Saturday night's main event shows exclusive to Peacock, it's smart. And it also means that I have to keep the cock now. So, well played, WWE. Well played. So all of this is a lot to take in. There's been a lot of news. This is a flurry, a hurricane of news coming fast and furious these past few weeks. So it can be a lot to digest. The WWE archives are something I've been asked a lot about this week. I've been curious about it myself, but there are a lot of people that don't know what's going on, so they've been asking me. The classic content will continue to be available on Peacock through the end of this year. And unless they strike a deal with Peacock or someone else for the rights to the library, that means that as of January 1st, there are no more archives. They will no longer have a home. They're going to be disappearing 3 months earlier than expected. Now, I'm sure they're going to work something out before then. Maybe it'll migrate over to ESPN. But if they don't make a deal by then, we will no longer have access to that content until they do. outside of whatever they upload to the WWE vault on YouTube. And honestly, I've been spending most of my time on there anyway when it comes to the classic stuff. I love the vault. If they want to add more content to the vault, I'm all in favor of it. But they still need to have that one central location where you can navigate through full episodes of whatever it is that you're looking for. And yeah, you can kind of do that with the playlists that they put together on the Vault channel, but it's not the same thing. You know, it's not the same layout as what the WWE Network was or what Peacock is or what it would be on Netflix. So hopefully they will land somewhere where they can store all of that, and not just store all of it, but continue uploading new content. You know, the reason that they slowed down on doing that, and they really don't update a lot of classic stuff anymore on there, is because the audience just isn't there for it. But I hope that they, at least for the people who are interested in that content, that they will start uploading more stuff. It's not like everything's on Peacock. There's a lot that's missing. And that they just sort of stopped, and they need to pick up with that. But I think they also need to just do a better job of advertising that it's available. And they don't do that because they just assume nobody's going to care. But if they at least put a little more effort into advertising the fact that, hey, you know, guess what? We've got this entire library of stuff. Here's some highlights of, you know, what happened this week, 25 years ago, 35 years ago. And, you know, little, almost like little bumpers coming in and out of commercial breaks on some of the shows, you know, that might go a long way. You know, it's sort of like out of sight, out of mind. And especially with newer fans, they may not even know that this stuff is there or be given a reason to care about it. So I'd like to see them ratchet, you know, that up when the content moves to wherever it's going to move to. But my fear is that it's just not important to them. You know, the real estate on television is just, it's too important for them to waste it on promoting the fact that you can get old episodes of primetime wrestling from 1988. And I get it, I understand it, but I just wish it wasn't like that. The mystery of what's going on with Naomi is a mystery no more. Adam Pearce introduced her out to the ring on Raw Monday night to announce that she and Jimmy Uso are having a baby. Baby Uso is on the way. Actually, they announced it together on a bonus episode of Stephanie McMahon's podcast, since the pod that they did together the week before was actually taped before SummerSlam, before she even knew that she was pregnant. And after the announcement was made on Monday night, she immediately went back into heel Naomi mode and cut a promo on Adam Pearce, telling him that she knows what it's like to surrender a title and hand over a title before, and she wasn't handing him shit. Told him to get out of her face. And then she put the entire women's division on notice that they have 9 months and some change to hold the title before she takes it back. As far as announcements like this go, like an injury where somebody has to give up their title, this was one of the best. This was the highlight of the show. Now, obviously, the timing of this is terrible career-wise for her, because she was just starting her run as champion and really settling in nicely in the heel role. There was a void in that spot after Liv Morgan got hurt, and Naomi moved right into that spot pretty seamlessly. Now she and Liv are both gone, which presents an opportunity for somebody else. But look, you can't predict when these things are going to happen. You know, she's obviously very happy, but you could tell from her demeanor on Stephanie's podcast, she's still struggling with the timing of it. Like it's a bittersweet thing for her. She told Stephanie that she found out she was pregnant on August 10th, the day before she was slated to defend her title on Raw against Io Sky. She said, "In my hotel room, I'd been feeling a little bit different, a little weird. Just wanted to take a test to find out and make sure, kind of rule it out, not thinking, because it's been a long journey with fertility issues that I've had. So yeah, I really just didn't think it was possible." And she revealed that before she made her debut on the main roster as a Funkadactyl, she underwent a procedure called an oophorectomy, where she had her right ovary removed. And then in 2020, she underwent a procedure to remove fibroids from her uterus. She said, "I had tons and big ones, and it was only supposed to be a couple of hours, the surgery, but she ended up being in there for 6 hours. Then she had to take 6 months off to recover. And her last match, from what I can tell, her last match was in August of that year, which was a beat-the-clock match against Bayley, and then we didn't see her again until the Royal Rumble. And she figured due to her medical history, the chances of her and Jimmy conceiving a child naturally were just not that high. She said the surgery was more intense and severe than they thought it was initially, and just the healing and also a lot of scar tissue. On top of being older, I'm 37 now, and on top of only having one ovary, we thought for sure that naturally, I just couldn't anymore. And she also said her pregnancy is considered high risk, so she'll be going for checkups more often, but so far everything is looking good, which is great to hear. Well, I mean, look, the other women have Jimmy, Big Jim, to thank now for eliminating some of their competition. She said that she's 7 weeks pregnant, which means that when she cashed in her money in the bank to win the world title, she was with child, which makes her the first Money in the Bank winner to do so, if there is a category for such a thing. If not, there is now. They didn't announce anything as far as the Women's Championship goes, but with one Raw left before Clash in Paris, they're going to have to make a decision tomorrow, or not tomorrow, but I'm so used to doing these shows on Sunday. They're going to have to make a decision on Monday. And I still maintain the easiest thing to do and the most sensible idea is to make a match between Io Sky and Stephanie Vaquer. Because Io was supposed to get a title match with Naomi, which never happened, right? That's when she found out she was pregnant. The match got called off. Stephanie won a battle royal at Evolution to earn a championship match. Turning it into a multi-person match would not be very fair to Stephanie. Now, would it, right? She earned a match against the champion. Io is owed a match. Just do Io Sky against Stephanie Vaquer for the vacant title. That's all you really need to do. Now, they could add Roxanne Perez to the match if they want to, because Roxanne could argue she pinned Io 2 weeks ago, which she did. That was the replacement match for Io against Naomi. They did Io against Roxanne, and Roxanne pinned Io Sky, something that Rhea Ripley has never been able to do. So you could make it a triple threat. You could have Io pin Roxanne to get her win back, and that also spares them from having to pin Stephanie. Because even if they do Io against Stephanie, I would have Io win the title back. Like Stephanie Vaquer getting pinned in a competitive match by Io Sky, not a big deal. I'm just saying if they turn it into a triple threat or a fatal four-way or something like that, you could then spare Stephanie from having to take the pin, if that matters, if that's a big deal. But I just think it's way too soon to belt up Stephanie. She's barely even been on the show since Evolution. She's almost been forgotten about. Just put the belt back on Io until Perth in October. And in Perth, Rhea Ripley finally beats Io Sky for the first time. And she wins back the Women's World Championship. She runs with it for a few months until they're ready to do Rhea against Stephanie next year, maybe at WrestleMania. Stephanie wins the championship from Rhea Ripley. That'll be a big, big win for her. That's it. That's really all you have to do. And Liv Morgan is probably going to be back, I would imagine, in time for the Royal Rumble, probably the beginning of next year. It doesn't need to be for the championship. You can go into a program or, you know, a story with her and Roxanne. That would be a solid sort of underneath story that doesn't really need the championship. So as far as like the key players are concerned, and that doesn't even include whatever Becky Lynch is going to be doing, that accounts for most of the key players on the Raw side. And that takes you right into, you know, WrestleMania season. And that leads nicely into my Clash in Paris predictions for next Sunday with a 2 p.m. Eastern start time. And just like Forbidden Door tomorrow, my plan is to go live at 8 p.m. that night. I think that'll work well tomorrow. And if it does, we'll do the same thing for Clash in Paris next weekend. And then we'll push the podcast out a day early. I have not seen any attendance numbers for this show. It's an indoor arena, but it's a big one. It fits up to 45,000 people for concerts. For a show like this, it's probably more like 30 to 35,000, which is still a lot of people. But there was a note in the Observer this week that tickets have not been selling that well because they completely priced themselves out of the market with their most expensive seats. People are not buying them up like they expected them to. And look, they're still going to have a lot of people there, and it should be very loud, but it definitely will not be sold out, which can only mean one thing. Ari Emanuel is on the phone as we speak to Dwayne. Dwayne, we need you. We need you. We need you to come snatch up some souls. So the card right now is incomplete. This is pending their decision on the women's world title situation and what other matches they might add. They have a few possibilities. Cody Rhodes against Drew McIntyre for the WWE title being the most obvious one, but that just feels like a WrestlePalooza match to me. Plus, Cody missed SmackDown again this week, so there's not enough time to set that up for Paris anyway. Maybe Becky Lynch on that show defends her Intercontinental title against Nikki Bella. Maybe Dominic Mysterio defends his Intercontinental title against AJ Styles. Sami Zayn, we know, is getting a U.S. title match against Solo Sikoa in Lyon, France on SmackDown next week. So that will not be on the PLE. But here is what the card looks like as of right now. Sheamus and Rusev, they have been fighting like cats and dogs for weeks now. They're both even at one win apiece. And now they're actually getting a PLE spot. The only other PLE match that Sheamus has been a part of all year was the Royal Rumble. And if you can believe it, this will mark his first singles match on a PLE in 3 years. You would have to go all the way back to Clash at the Castle in 2022 when he challenged Gunther for the Intercontinental title. That was the last time. Outside of that, it's been all tags and triple threats and War Games matches, and not even that many of them. But this time it'll be a good old-fashioned Donnybrook match, which is basically anything goes, but with barrels at ringside. I mean, maybe they can play him out to the ring to roll out the barrel. It would still be better than that garbage that Def Rebel gave him. I think Sheamus wins this. He's one and one in Donnybrook matches so far. He lost one to Drew McIntyre, and he beat Pete Dunne in the other. But this is his specialty. I think the babyface wins this, so I'm going with Sheamus. Again, the Women's World Championship will be decided on this show. How exactly, we don't know, but so long as Io Sky is in the match, I'm picking Io Sky to win the belt back. I know she's got her own story going on right now with Rhea Ripley and the Kabuki Warriors. It's probably building to a tag team match. If they put the title on Stephanie, I'm fine with it. I just think it's too soon to do that. If they put the title on Roxanne, because apparently they're very, very high on Roxanne, I would not hate it, but I really don't think she needs it when Liv Morgan comes back. Io Sky is the way to go. She is your next Women's World Champion. Roman Reigns returned on Raw Monday night. He came to the aid of Jey Uso in his Extreme Rules match against Bron Breakker. He challenged Bronson Reed to a match in Paris. Reed accepted, and he promised to steal Roman's shoes again. I don't see Roman Reigns losing to Bronson Reed. Bron Breakker? Sure, maybe. But not Bronson Reed. Because Roman is likely disappearing again after this match because he's scheduled to go film for Street Fighter all of next month through the 26th, I believe, is what PW Insider was reporting. So, I mean, if he's going away, you could destroy him first, even if you don't beat him. I still don't think he's going to lose, but you could do an angle after the match where, you know, you kind of destroy him and send him on his way. The thing is, though, like, he just got destroyed. He's already coming off of an angle where he got destroyed and he was gone for a few weeks. Now, granted, it was all of 2 weeks, but they already did an angle like that. I don't know if they want to do another one again so soon after the last one. I don't even know if he's going to be on Raw that Monday. He starts filming on September 2nd, I believe. That's the day after Raw, and they're filming in Australia. So he may not even be there. I mean, that Clash in Paris match may be it for him for the next month. But I'm going with Roman Reigns to win. John Cena goes one-on-one with Logan Paul. This is not a match that I have been terribly excited about, although Logan Paul was the MVP of that tag team match, the celebrity match at SummerSlam with, you know, Jelly Roll. And he's had some great matches. Absolutely. And I always give him credit for the matches that he has. He goes out there and more often than not, he tries to steal the show, and a lot of times he does. So him against John Cena, in many ways, he's a really good opponent for John Cena, because whatever John Cena can't do, Logan Paul can. And Logan Paul can, you know, bump all over the place for him and do all kinds of stuff that John Cena can react to, but John Cena is not going to be the one doing all these dazzling, you know, show-stealing moves here. So in that regard, I think he's a good opponent for him, but I can't say that this match had me terribly excited. And then we got to SmackDown on Friday night, and John Cena was back, and John Cena was on SmackDown in Dublin, Ireland, and he didn't even get a word out before Logan Paul crashed the party. and Logan Paul cut a promo on John Cena. And it was fine. Yeah, it was a perfectly fine promo. But then John Cena got to retort. And he took the microphone, and for the next 5 minutes straight, he cut what was easily one of the best promos of this entire retirement run so far. It is something that is worth going out of your way to watch the whole thing in full. I cannot say that he buried Logan Paul. I mean, in some ways he did, but this was not a promo where he buried Logan Paul. He put the man over for his abilities. He was careful at the beginning of this to put him over and call him a future WWE champion, a future WrestleMania main eventer. And he's looking at the fans and going, guys, I know you don't like it. I know you don't want to hear it, but he's not going nowhere. We're not going to get rid of him. You know, he's here to stay, and he's actually really, really good. But then from there, he went the opposite way, and he focused on the criticisms that a lot of fans have about him and a lot of the things the fans don't like about him and how disrespectful he can be. And now they're kind of playing it up for the story about how disrespectful he can be and, well, you're only here to take advantage of us and use us, and he's showing us the prime hydration station at ringside and talking about his drone, and you're here for moments and all this other stuff. But there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. And even if there isn't a lot of truth, there's a lot of fans who believe a lot of what he was saying here in this promo. And he's tapping into all these different criticisms. But he did it in a way where it was some of the best work I've seen from him on the mic all year. Like, when Cena is on, he is untouchable. He really, and we've seen that before, right? We saw that in the promo years ago with Roman Reigns, the big dog, where he just eviscerated him and embarrassed him on the mic. Like, one of the most embarrassing moments ever in a promo segment like that that I can remember, especially with like two top guys, was when Roman lost his train of thought in that promo. And Cena literally is just kind of leaning back up against the ropes, and he just goes, take your time. Take your time. And then he said some other stuff as well, but then he hit him with that line, you know, there at the end about how, you know, I came back because you can't do your job. He'll always get like at least that one line in there that just burns the other person to the ground. And Austin Theory, you know, a few years ago, forget about it. That was just a complete burial job. And Austin Theory was never the same after that. So this wasn't quite that bad. This wasn't as biting as that was. But even here, you know, he's going on about how, you know, these fans resent you because you've, you know, wasted part of what little time I have left here in this retirement run, where I could be working with like future legends and stars like Dominic Mysterio and AJ Styles and Seth Rollins and Jacob Fatu. And so, you know, the fans don't appreciate the fact that I'm wasting my time with you. You know, and I'm wasting my time with a back-flipping YouTuber who's, you know, pushing salt water and just on and on and on and just really lacing into this guy. But he's all up at his face and he says, you know, look, Clash in Paris is an opportunity for you to prove yourself. It's a proving ground, in effect, for Logan Paul. It's really nice, you know, that you've had 23 wonderful matches so far in your WWE career, but I've had 23 years worth of matches in my career. You've got some catching up to do. And so just from start to finish, top to bottom, I thought that this was just excellent stuff. Easily the highlight of the show on Friday. And now there's a story there that I can buy into. Right now I have a reason to actually care about this match just based on what John Cena was saying in that promo. He was able to kind of reel me in. And that's what I was looking for here. They made the match, and it's like, okay, great, you made the match, but like there's no real hook there. And I felt like he gave us that hook on Friday night, as best as they can. Now, later on in the show, McIntyre was in the back, Drew McIntyre. He was talking to Logan Paul, and he was telling him, like, this isn't 2010. This isn't Super Cena. You've got to show him what you can do tonight. Like, you've got to retaliate, basically, for what he just did to you out there. And it was very interesting that McIntyre was the one giving him this pep talk and saying all these things about John Cena, because it felt to me like they were planting the seed for a future match, possibly, between McIntyre and Cena. I don't want to say McIntyre is going to be John Cena's retirement opponent, but I definitely think he's, you know, under consideration for that. I mean, I think that Gunther and John Cena is the match that I would like to see, but if they went with Drew McIntyre, I mean, that works too. Or maybe the answer lies in the list of names that Cena rattled off, you know, against Logan last night in the ring. All those people, you know, that he could be wrestling instead of Logan Paul. Again, he named Dominic Mysterio, and I don't think it's going to be Dom, but he named AJ Styles. I would love to see another John Cena-AJ Styles match. Do I see that as his retirement match? I don't. But you know who I could see? Jacob Fatu. Jacob Fatu is another name that he dropped. You know, and it's another babyface like AJ is. I don't think that would stop them from doing babyface against babyface and Cena's retirement match. But Jacob Fatu maybe is on that short list as well of potential opponents. If you were to ask me right now, who do I think is the favorite, or there's a list, I don't even have like a top three. I have a top two of guys who I would, A, love to see wrestle John Cena, and realistically, I think it could be either one of them. It's Gunther and Drew McIntyre. I really do. I think it's probably going to end up being one of those two, and in either case, I'm okay with that. But after what McIntyre said to Logan in the back, it led to the closing segment on the show on Friday, which was Nick Aldis rushing out. As Cena was leaving, Nick Aldis rushes over to him and says, "I just got off the phone with Brock Lesnar." And before he could tell Cena whatever it is that he was going to tell him, Logan Paul flies in with a right hand and a knockout shot. That missed by a good 6 inches, because this man was being very careful not to really punch John Cena in the jaw. Probably has that jaw insured for his next movie. But I was watching it on international Netflix with the VPN, so I saw it live in the afternoon on Friday. And then I saw that when it aired on USA later that night, it looked bad enough. And they recognized that it looked bad enough from that angle that they actually reshot the entire scene. And this wasn't just the same scene from a different angle. Like, this was a completely different scene. They just reshot it afterwards, this time from a different perspective, so it didn't look as bad. But he left John Cena laying, which I think he kind of had to do to get that heat back. I know they have one more SmackDown before Clash in Paris, but, you know, whether it was last night or whether it was next week, Logan getting his heat back in some way makes sense, because I just don't see him going over here. I've got John Cena beating Logan Paul. And then we have Seth Rollins in the main event defending the World Heavyweight Championship against CM Punk, LA Knight, and Jey Uso. Rollins just cashed in to win the title at SummerSlam. No matter how hard they try to sell us on his title being in jeopardy because it's three other men and he doesn't have to be pinned to lose the championship, it's a tough sell because no one sees him dropping that title here. If Punk gets the belt back, it won't be until WrestleMania. LA Knight winning the title just doesn't seem realistic anymore. And Jey Uso shouldn't even be in this match. I don't even think he's in the match to eat the pin. I think that's why LA Knight is in there. Who gets the next shot, though, at WrestlePalooza or at Crown Jewel? That I don't know. Could be Punk again. I mean, it's the feud that'll never die. But one thing I can tell you is that Seth Rollins is walking in as the World Heavyweight Champion to Paris, and he will be leaving as the World Heavyweight Champion. Seth Rollins will win the Fatal 4-Way match. This week's episode is sponsored by Green Chef. When you think about summer, you want to have your best beach bod, right? And what you eat has a lot to do with that. But even when the summer comes to an end, that doesn't make it okay to just start eating whatever you want, regardless of how bad it may be for you. Like, that's my attitude. I want to make sure I'm eating well all year round because my health is important. It's about adopting eating habits that I know I can stick to. That's the beauty of Green Chef, the number one meal kit for clean eating. Green Chef makes it easy to spend less time in the kitchen and more time doing the other things that you would rather be doing this summer. And with their new Heat and Eat meals, you could enjoy a delicious meal in under 3 minutes with fresh, organic, seasonal produce and 100% responsibly sourced proteins to help you feel your best. We're talking real ingredients. Enjoy salads ready in just 5 minutes, protein-filled breakfasts, or nutrient-filled smoothies to fuel your entire day. With 80-plus dietitian-approved weekly meal options, Green Chef makes it easy to find meals that fit your lifestyle, from Mediterranean and gluten-free to plant-based and protein-heavy to gut and brain health and calorie-smart options, too. The recipes change every week, and with week-to-week flexibility, you can adjust your plan to match your mood and your schedule. As someone that has tried Green Chef for myself and had meals sent right to my doorstep, I can vouch for how easy they are to make and the fact that they passed my taste test. One of my favorite meals I had a while back was their chicken with basil pea stew with roasted red peppers and jasmine rice. It was fantastic. It's hard to mess up a chicken dish with me, but it has been done before. Thankfully, this wasn't one of those times. As far as getting everything together, it was super easy. You know, they list out everything you need, any food allergens that you need to know about, which I appreciate. And it was a great time saver for me before getting ready to go to work and do some live streaming for you guys. Make this summer your healthiest yet with Green Chef. Head to greenchef.com/50Solomonster and use code 50Solomonster to get 50% off your first month, then 20% off for 2 months with free shipping. That's code 50Solomonster at greenchef.com/50Solomonster. Chris Jericho was in the news this week, and not because he is scheduled to be back soon on AEW television. He may never be back on AEW television ever again, if these reports are to be believed. Jericho has not been in the ring since losing the Ring of Honor World Championship to Bandido at Dynasty back in April. And the following Dynamite, where he told Big Bill and Brian Keith that he was disappointed in them, and until they change that, it's best that he leaves, that was the last time we saw him. The real reason that he left was twofold. Number one, he had a Fozzy tour coming up. That tour ran through the middle of May. Number two, it was reported at the time that Jericho felt his character needed a reset, and it would be best to take himself off TV for a while, which was absolutely needed. I mean, this guy was as stale as a month-old loaf of bread. Now it's been 4 months since he's been seen on TV, and there's a lot of chatter about his AEW contract, which is due to expire at the end of this year. Dave Meltzer on Wrestling Observer Radio said, Jericho's actually a really big story. His contract is up at the end of the year, or late in the year, and there's certainly been lots and lots of talk about WWE. I know from a WWE standpoint, there is lots of talk there about Jericho. You know, people speculating Royal Rumble. Nobody has officially said anything, nor will anyone officially say anything. So that's from Dave. Fightful followed up with their own report on Wednesday that confirmed Jericho is signed with AEW until the end of 2025, so he still has many months left on his deal. Big Bill and Brian Keith are no longer listed as part of the learning tree. The WWE rumors started up after Jericho liked an Instagram post from somebody suggesting a WWE return. That's really what got all this started. And Jericho's very good at being able to kind of read the room and know how to get people to talk about him. And all it took was one liked Instagram post, and social media just got set ablaze with all kinds of rumors and conspiracy theories and fantasy booking scenarios about a Royal Rumble return and a WrestleMania return, like all these things that started really all from that one thing. But the Fightful report also said that one WWE higher-up said Jericho is on good terms with the company. The boys from WrestleVotes Radio have said, we can confirm after speaking to our sources that there is significant interest in Chris Jericho coming back to WWE once his AEW contract would allow him to do so. We're told that several within WWE, including active talent, would like to see him return. Despite spending the last 6 years with AEW, Jericho has remained friendly with a number of people inside WWE, we are told. And according to that source, they ultimately do expect the deal to be completed once Chris is legally able to do so. I am still not convinced that this is not going to end up being more of a way for Jericho to leverage even more money out of Tony Khan for a new deal. And it would be very smart of him to do so. You know, if he does want to stay with AEW, how do you maximize your value with your deal coming up by teasing a return to WWE? Now, when Randy Orton's contract was coming up for expiration in 2019, he used AEW, which was only first starting up at the time. He used AEW as leverage to get himself a better deal and a lot more money to stay with WWE. It's smart business. Jericho could well be doing the same thing here, right? Liking a post here and there, or if he starts dropping cryptic teases. Maybe he doesn't want to leave. But we don't even know for sure that Tony Khan cares enough to keep him around if he's effectively going to be bidding against himself. You know, Jericho's an interesting case because he has done so much in his career. He's reinvented himself multiple times. He's gone through different character transformations and has been more successful than not with it. But this most recent time with the Learning Tree stuff, like it really felt like the bloom was finally off the rose. If we're being honest, it's been that way for a while now, even before the Learning Tree. But no one can deny his importance to AEW when that company was first getting off the ground. I mean, more than Cody Rhodes, more than the Young Bucks, more than Kenny Omega. The Jericho signing in 2019 was Tony Khan's most important signing for that launch. He was able to sign away a major name from WWE, an established name on television that people knew, with a proven track record of success on the national stage. It's why I said at the time when it was Jericho against Hangman Page to crown the first AEW World Champion that Jericho was the logical choice. Hangman was not established yet, and Jericho was, right? Put the belt on Jericho. It's a face that people watching on TNT would instantly recognize if they're any kind of real wrestling fan. And then from there, you could build your new stars up. Guys like Hangman and Darby and MJF and Sammy Guevara. And there was value in Jericho forming the inner circle and surrounding himself with younger talent that he could try to elevate. Sammy Guevara, he benefited from it to a degree. Sammy had his own issues that killed his momentum there for a while. Jake Hager and Santana and Ortiz, it actually got to a point where Santana and Ortiz, they were wasting away as background players to Jericho. Like, that stuff was going on for so long and there was no upward mobility for them that it was actually working against them. Like, how much did it really help those guys, like Hager and Santana and Ortiz, like in the big picture? Not much. Then it was the Jericho Appreciation Society. And they threw Daniel Garcia in there and Matt Menard and Angelo Parker, two guys that WWE got rid of. Jericho threw them a lifeline. Two fellow Canadians. Daniel Garcia, there was potential there with him and Jericho in the ROH title, and there was an obvious story which they teased, and they never explored it after the big swerve they did. You know, I can understand trying to get him to show more personality instead of just being the great technical wrestler and saying, okay, you know what, instead of having him in the Blackpool Combat Club, we'll have him in the Jericho Appreciation Society, and he came up with that silly dance that got over for a minute. But he probably should have ended up in the Blackpool Combat Club with Bryan Danielson. Then came the Learning Tree, which seemed to be building to a split with him and Big Bill and an eventual match between the two of them, and then Jericho went on hiatus. And now, we're never getting that blow-off with Jericho and Big Bill, because even if Jericho comes back, it looks like the Learning Tree stuff is just over. If he comes back, it'll be something completely new. You know, I'll give him credit for working with Orange Cassidy and putting him over, because OC, he did come out of that better off than he went into it. But for so many others, this is why it became a running joke. The Jericho Vortex, it's a real thing. And I don't mean that in a good way. You know, he would work with guys like Ricky Starks and work with a guy like Action Andretti and Hook and even put some of them over in the end. But how many of them were truly elevated by working with Jericho? How many of them came out of those feuds and those programs better off coming out of them? You can't put all of that on Jericho. A lot of it is also the booking and Tony Khan's inability to follow up with them in any kind of meaningful way. He gets blamed for it too. But even Jericho's program with someone like Adam Cole or the stuff he did with Eddie Kingston, it was to their detriment. Like, I remember Eddie Kingston and Chris Jericho had a really good match at Revolution a few years ago. But after that, it just dragged on endlessly for months and months. And the question needs to be asked, what value does Chris Jericho bring to AEW in the year 2025? You know, the answer in 2019 was a lot of value. In 2025, not so much. You know, we helped get the company off the ground, and they're secure for the time being. They got their $600 million media rights deal. You know, Jericho does not move the needle for them anymore. He hasn't for a long time. Tony Khan put the Ring of Honor World Championship on him twice with the idea that it might help them secure a television deal for Ring of Honor, and that never materialized. In the ring, with the right opponent, he can still have a solid match. I mean, like that last one he had with Bandido, right? And how much of that was Bandido? Bandido's awesome. But, I mean, those are few and far between these days. He's 54 years old now, and he looks it when he's in the ring. Outside of being a veteran presence behind the scenes and helping out in that capacity, I don't see where he brings any value to the AEW product anymore. Not on camera. And he won't move the needle for WWE either, outside of that initial return. And that's really his best bet at this point. If he goes back to WWE, it's going to generate a lot of excitement initially because it's been almost a decade since the last time we saw him on their TV. And there are a lot of WWE fans that don't watch AEW. So Chris Jericho shows up all of a sudden as a surprise. It's like, oh my God, where's he been? Chris Jericho's back. I haven't seen him in 8 years. Right? The last time he wrestled for WWE was the greatest Royal Rumble. And think about that. That was the very first Saudi Arabia show that they ever did. They've done a lot more since then. They say absence makes the heart grow fonder. And also nostalgia. It's a hell of a drug. So a surprise Royal Rumble return would be something I could see happening, and that would be something that would generate a lot of reaction. Funny enough, if he did make a surprise Royal Rumble return next year, the Royal Rumble is in Saudi Arabia, which is the last place that we saw him working in the ring for WWE. But like a surprise Rumble return, a Hall of Fame induction is inevitable, and then a part-time schedule. That would be the way to go with Jericho in WWE. When I say part-time, I'm talking no more than half a dozen PLE matches and working some international tours. That's it. That's it. That's all it needs to be. So there is value in him having one last run there, but less is more with him at this point. In AEW, he just overstayed his welcome. But there are other considerations if you're Jericho. He has outside projects. He's got his podcast, Talk is Jericho. What happens with that? You know, WWE's been building up their own podcast network. Do they just add his show to their lineup? Do they take ownership of that? I mean, Undertaker ditched his old co-host, Matt, and dropped him like a bad habit to take the check from WWE and replace Matt with his wife as his co-host. Cody Rhodes, he's got his podcast. Stephanie McMahon has her podcast. So, I mean, I could see Jericho's landing there, but that's not all he has. He has the Jericho Cruise, which he's been doing since 2018. He's got another one scheduled for November of next year. He took the cruise idea originally to WWE. He took it to Triple H, but they shot it down. He wanted to get some WWE talent on the tour, on the cruise, and they basically told him in so many words to fuck off. Once AEW started up, he was able to get all these AEW stars to come on the boat and do live matches. I mean, look at the talent lineup for the most recent cruise. Will Ospreay, Tony Storm, Bobby Lashley, MVP, Takeshita, Ricochet, and like 20 others. 75% of the AEW roster ended up on that cruise. If he goes back to WWE, he's not going to be getting AEW talents on that cruise anymore. He's going to lose access to all of those people. Would WWE work with him and allow him to book their talents on the cruise and get legends booked on the cruise? Probably not. None of the big names anyway. I mean, look, admittedly, it's a little bit different when Dynamite airs on a Wednesday in the middle of the week. You know, WWE's got SmackDown on Fridays. They got Raw on Mondays. I think the cruise usually takes off on a Thursday, comes back on a Monday. So no, you're not going to have access to, you know, that many big name talents. Does the cruise go away? Does he want to continue to do it? Is he willing to sacrifice it just to go back to WWE? What about Fozzy? He's got another tour scheduled in the UK next February, right smack in the middle of Royal Rumble season and Elimination Chamber season. So all that to say, you know, for Jericho, he's got a lot to think about because even if he's just part-time, he's got a lot on his plate that he doesn't necessarily want to give up. Vince McMahon is not there anymore. Maybe they would be more willing to work with him now. But in his mind, maybe it's easier to sign with Tony for more money for another 2 or 3 years. Take the money and just be able to do all these other ancillary things that he's doing. Does Tony Khan want to keep Chris Jericho? That's the other question here. I cannot imagine, personally, I cannot imagine that he would not make a play to keep Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho is the first ever AEW world champion. Tony loves Jericho. Would he really just let him walk without trying to keep him? I highly doubt that. So it may come down to that as much as anything. How far is Tony willing to go to keep Jericho at a time when Jericho has less value to him in ring than he ever has in the 6 years that he's been with the company? Is he willing to break the bank Okada style to keep Chris Jericho, even if it's just to keep him from going back to WWE? Or does Tony see things the same way, that he's gotten all that he can out of Jericho and it's time to move on peacefully, respectfully, without any drama? Basically the opposite of how Cody Rhodes left and how CM Punk left. There's no need to burn any bridges here. Does he let him walk or not without a fight? One thing about Jericho, I will give the man his flowers. I may not have been much of a fan the last few years, but whatever he does, his body of work and what he has been able to achieve in his career over the course of 30 plus years is among the greatest careers that anybody has ever had in the history of the business. He made money and he found success everywhere he went, from ECW to WCW to WWE to New Japan to AEW, all of them. Tony Khan has said he credits the match that Jericho had with Kenny Omega at the Tokyo Dome as the inspiration for starting AEW, because that match did big box office. And it confirmed to him that there was a market outside of WWE for pro wrestling that was not being serviced at the time. So he's had a very blessed career. And I know he's still having fun and he has no plans to quit anytime soon. That's what he said. But there's a right way and a wrong way to use Chris Jericho. And whether he stays or whether he goes, whoever he works for, I hope they're smart enough to know the difference between right and wrong. Forbidden Door is tomorrow from the O2 Arena in London. At Wembley, they get the bigger crowds, and it's an outdoor stadium. This is not. They're going to be back at Wembley next year, but they're going to end up sold out here with over 17,000 fans in an indoor arena where it should be very loud and very energetic. Whatever you want to say about their domestic attendance, and it's not great, they don't have any of those same struggles in the UK since they don't run there as often. So these shows always make them feel major league. It's funny. I was talking to my brother earlier today, actually, and mentioned that, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be watching Forbidden Door, middle of the day. And he, because he doesn't watch AEW week to week, he's aware of it, but he doesn't watch it. So he looked at the roster and he was appalled by how many titles there are. Like, he saw Okada was the unified champion and he assumed that he must be the top champion in the company. So I had to explain to him why he's not and how the whole unified title situation works. And then he asked about Mercedes and all of her belts, and I just gave up. I just said, you know what, this is a lost cause. But just an interesting perspective there from someone who is casual at best when it comes to AEW. But here is the card as it currently stands. This doesn't account for any pre-show 0 hour matches that they're going to add, undoubtedly, because 0 hour starts either at 11 a.m. or 11:30 a.m. The main card starts at 1 p.m. Eastern. Kyle Fletcher defends the TNT Championship against Hiromu Takahashi of New Japan. That will be a win for Kyle Fletcher. IWGP World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Zack Sabre Jr. defends against Nigel McGuinness, who will have Daniel Garcia in his corner. Daniel Garcia was one of the men that Nigel beat out in the four-way match on Collision last week to earn the shot, and Danny looked very frustrated and upset when he lost. Nigel extended the invitation for him to be in his corner. He accepted. I have questions about Daniel Garcia and what his motivations will be here. I think we're headed for a Daniel Garcia heel turn, potentially. Whether it costs Nigel the match or it comes after the match, Nigel, either way, is not winning the title. It's cool to see him in this spot and getting a shot in London. But Zack Sabre Jr. will leave, still the IWGP champion, no doubt about that. Mercedes Moné defends her TBS Women's Championship in a four-way match against Alex Winza, representing AEW. Persephone, representing CMLL, and Bozilla representing Stardom. And I said, you know, with Bozilla, I said it on Wednesday, they've got a German wrestler representing a Japanese company on a British event being hosted by an American company. And she is someone who is very young. She's only 21, not a lot of experience, not a lot of time in Stardom. She's been there barely 2 months. We didn't even know who was going to be in the match until they put the graphic up on the screen on Wednesday telling us, oh, Bozilla will be in there. And I can imagine some people watching this going, who? The fuck is Bozilla? Well, you'll find out on Sunday because she's going to be in the four-way match. She has no shot of winning, but she'll be in the four-way match. Yeah, there is no way that Mercedes is losing her title here. There's absolutely no way. And Mercedes, by the way, is now Mercedes Nine Belts. She won her ninth championship. There was a Rev Pro show on Friday night, and she won her ninth title, and only the TBS title on the line here, though. No way she's losing. No way she should be losing. She's getting very close to beating Jade Cargill as the longest reigning TBS champion of all time. There's no reason to think that Tony would do anything to jeopardize that at this point or take the title off of her before then. So Mercedes will win. We have the AEW World Tag Team titles on the line. The Hurt Syndicate, Bobby Lashley and Shelton Benjamin defend in a three-way match for the second pay-per-view in a row. They did the same shit at All In Texas. They're doing it again here. Three-way match against FTR and Brodito, the team of Brody King and Bandido. They had the finals of this tournament on Wednesday to crown number one contenders. Brodito and FTR went to a 30-minute draw. That is how this ended up as a three-way match. And there have also been a lot of stories of late, a lot of rumors, a lot of reports about the Hurt Syndicate and or MVP specifically not liking pitches for his team to drop their titles to FTR. And this has come from multiple places now, right? I saw Fightful mention something about this about a week or so ago. I think there's smoke to the fire. And I've already commented on how I feel about that, and it really should not be anyone's decision but Tony Khan, who I think has been more than generous with the way that he has booked and presented the Hurt Syndicate on television for the entire year now that they have held those tag team titles. And Tony has another story in mind. And that story involves FTR winning the titles and going to Toronto next month. And if Tony Khan wants FTR, for example, to win the tag team titles or Brodito or anybody else, then that's exactly what should happen, regardless of how the Hurt Syndicate, regardless of how MVP feels about it. And yet now, amidst all of these reports, this turns into a three-way match. And I can't help but sit here and wonder if that has a little something to do with these reports that we've heard about. But then I read on their Twitter, and I didn't realize this until yesterday, because they didn't say a damn word about this on television, but apparently this is an elimination match. This is not even a traditional three-way like the one that we had in Texas. This is an elimination match. So it makes me wonder, will they have Brodito shock the world and bounce Lashley and Benjamin out first so that guarantees that we're going to have new tag team champions? And then from there, have FTR pin Brodito to win the titles. So that way FTR does not pin Shelton Benjamin or Bobby Lashley. I'm sitting here trying to imagine Dax or Cash pinning Bobby Lashley. I can't see it. I don't see Shelton maybe, yes, maybe, but I don't see it happening with Bobby Lashley. And it may not happen at all. It may not happen with them at all, because it may well be that the Hurt Syndicate will lose, but they'll lose to Brodito, and then Brodito loses to FTR. Either way, I'm picking FTR to win the tag team titles here in this match. Adam Copeland and Christian Cage, they have reunited. Boy, that was quick. Feels a little rushed, doesn't it? But they reunited, and they're going to be taking, well, they were supposed to take on Nick Wayne and Kip Sabian, representing the Patriarchy, or now I guess it would be the Matriarchy. And then on Wednesday, Nick Wayne was on the Tron, and he had crutches. And he was not there in Glasgow with everybody else, and he said that he had a broken foot. And he said that it happened in the segment the week before, where Christian came at him with that spike board with the nails in it, and he, in dodging him and weaving out of the way, I mean, I went back and I watched that segment. He was moving around fine even after he got out of the ring. So I don't know exactly where the broken foot happened. I don't know how badly the foot is broken, but apparently it is a legitimate injury. He has a broken foot. I don't know what that means for his Ring of Honor television title, but at best, without surgery, he's probably going to be out a good 8 to 10 weeks. Or worse, if he needs surgery. And Dustin Rhodes just had double knee replacement surgery, and he's got two belts in Ring of Honor. He's the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champion and one-third of the six-man champions. So I don't know what the title situation is going to look like in Ring of Honor, if they're going to crown new champions or not. It's Ring of Honor. I mean, does anybody even care? You may as well just keep the belts on them. I don't even think anybody will notice. But since Nick Wayne is unable to compete, he's not medically cleared, he tapped a replacement. And that replacement is the returning Luchasaurus, or a Killswitch, I guess he's still being called. Killswitch came out. We haven't seen the dinosaur in almost a year. And it was really good to see him because there were some reports about his health situation earlier in the year that were very, very scary. And I talked about this in the Dynamite review on Wednesday. You know, he collapsed in his home late last year. I think his fiance found him and he had pneumonia in both of his lungs. He was having breathing issues. It was, his blood oxygen level was like 80 or something. It was scary. It was touch and go there for a while. And at the very least, there were questions about whether or not he'd even be able to get back in the ring. But there he was, and he looked like, you know, the old Luchasaurus, and he's going to take Nick Wayne's place in this match. It doesn't change the outcome here. Copeland and Christian, they almost have to win anyway if they're going to be getting a tag team title match at All Out, if that's where we're headed with this, challenging FTR. But it would be foolish to beat them anyway. I mean, this is going to be their first match as tag team partners in 14 years. 14 years. This is the reunion that Tony Khan has been dying to do, and probably the two of them have been dying to do. And I said it was rushed. We've seen this. I think a lot of us who watch the show pretty much figured this was going to be the inevitable direction. We just didn't know when they were going to actually pull the trigger and do it. When they did it a couple weeks ago, it felt very sudden. I was not expecting it to happen on that show. I wasn't even expecting it to happen necessarily before Forbidden Door. Maybe at Forbidden Door. Like, doing the hug and the reunion at Forbidden Door actually would have made more sense. You would have had a much bigger, hot crowd for it. I mean, they had 1,100 people in the fucking building when they did this big reunion between Edge and Christian on TV a couple of weeks ago. If you would have done it at Forbidden Door, you would have had 17,000 rabid UK fans there on a major pay-per-view who would have gone nuts for that. And then you save their first match together for All Out. Whether it's for the titles or not isn't even really relevant. But there they were a couple weeks ago, maybe it was Cincinnati, I think, in front of 1,100 people, and they did the hug, and it looked like Christian was a little resistant to it. So I said, we really need some kind of an explanation here about what's going on. We got to get these two in the ring together. And they did. They were in the ring with Tony Schiavone on Wednesday, and it was Christian's explanation. He said that it's not a case where things are suddenly good between the two of them, but they decided, it's kind of like a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, the enemy of my enemy is my friend type of situation, where he agreed to help Copeland with his FTR problem, and Copeland has agreed to help him with his patriarchy problem. So they have this mutual agreement with each other. Not that they're best buds again, but you know what? We have some issues here. I need your help. You need mine. So let's come together. I at least appreciated they tried to rationally explain it. Like, I think that's a fine explanation. This is not the way that I would have done all of this, but at least it was an explanation that you can make sense of. And here's the other thing about it that I like. Christian wasn't really acting any differently. And Copeland even said, he's an asshole, but he's my asshole. So we kind of get the best of both worlds here, because for the people who wanted to see a Copeland and Christian reunion, we're getting it without having to change Christian too much from the Christian that he has been. Christian as a babyface just feels wrong. I'm sorry. I don't want to see Christian as a babyface yet. I mean, he's been doing this, you know, the heel act and the father stuff now for a few years. And I think there's other ways that you can evolve it beyond just the, you know, your father is dead stuff. But Christian is just such a natural prick. He's just naturally hateable, just a great heel. And I don't think you should stray too far from that. And if the fans are going to cheer, let them cheer it. But I don't think you should stray far from the Christian that we get on TV now just because, oh, he's with Copeland, so he has to be a babyface. Like, I don't subscribe to that. So this is their way of sort of, you're getting your cake and eating it too. Not a doubt in my mind, though, that Copeland and Christian are going to win this match. Then we have Kazuchika Okada defending the Unified Championship against Swerve Strickland. Swerve is going into this match with a legitimate knee injury, which would explain why he hasn't wrestled a match since July 23rd. Per Fightful, he has been working with a torn meniscus in his knee for the last 6 years. Not weeks, not months, years. It's an injury that he suffered back in 2019 when he was still at the WWE Performance Center. I don't know why this is all of a sudden an issue now. If he's been working on it for 6 years, evidently he aggravated the injury, and there's no word on whether or not he'll be having surgery to repair the issue after the pay-per-view. Tony Khan has tapped into the Jacksonville Jaguars medical staff to help him through this injury. But now they've got their built-in excuse for when he loses this match to Okada, which he will. And Okada will retain the Unified Championship. I don't know if that's going to place certain limitations upon Swerve and what he can do in this match, because I think with both guys healthy, this could be a really good match. If Swerve is not 100% healthy, which obviously he isn't, I don't know how that affects the match. If it's mostly him just selling the knee, that could be very boring. We'll see what kind of match they have. The long-term play here, even if Swerve was 100% healthy, he should not win the championship. The long-term play here needs to be Okada and Takeshita. I don't know when. I don't know if they, you know, do it at the next pay-per-view. I don't know if they do it at World's End or Full Gear or early 2026. I don't know what's going to happen with Takeshita and the IWGP title because he just won the G1 Climax. And he said that he wants to win the championship before the Tokyo Dome. He wants to go into the Tokyo Dome as the champion. I don't really see them doing anything with him and Okada, if that's the case, until he drops that title, but he hasn't won that title yet, so we'll see what happens there. But to me, that's the long-term play. The AEW Women's World Championship is on the line. Timeless Toni Storm defends against Athena. Athena won the tag team main event on Dynamite Wednesday night. She was teaming with Mercedes against Toni Storm and Alex Windsor. She's also still the Ring of Honor Women's World Champion. And as I see it, there is only room for one belt collector gimmick at a time in this company. And that belongs to Mercedes. As I mentioned earlier, Mercedes just won her 9th belt on Friday. She beat Emerson Jane at the Rev Pro Show to win the Discovery Wrestling Scottish Women's Championship. Discovery Wrestling apparently is a thing. I wonder how many of these 9 titles that she has are actually active titles. Because I feel like not all of them are active titles. Like maybe 6 or 7 of them, maybe. But she's got 9 belts now. What an absolute nightmare that has to be to go through the airport, like airport security every week with those things. Because I think she brings them all with her everywhere she goes. Like all these shows. I don't care if she has clear. I don't care if she has TSA pre-check. Like, it doesn't matter. That's got to be a fucking nightmare everywhere that woman goes. As far as Toni Storm and Athena, I don't see Athena winning the championship. This is Athena cashing in her Casino Gauntlet contract that she won in Texas. She called her shot in advance, and I just don't see her winning the championship. I just don't see it. Especially after she won that main event on Wednesday. I'm like, yeah, she's not winning that title. Hangman Adam Page defends the AEW World Championship against MJF. MJF got Hangman on Wednesday to agree to 3 new stipulations for their match. With some help from Ricochet and the Gates of Agony, they kidnapped and tortured Mark Briscoe. And MJF threatened to set the man on fire. He poured gasoline on him. He had a match. He was ready to set him ablaze should Hangman not agree to his conditions. And as agreed to, the AEW World Championship now can change hands via countout, via disqualification. I think Triple H just got a little tingle up his spine when I mentioned that word. And also, MJF is no longer using his casino gauntlet contract for a guaranteed title match, meaning MJF, if he loses this match, he still will have the contract as a backup. He will still have it as an insurance policy that he can cash in at any time, even that night, if he chooses to do so. I don't think he will, not that night. And since he still has the contract, it doesn't make any sense for him to win the championship. What sense would that make? That would be dumb. So I got Hangman retaining. The only question is, do you see Mark Briscoe get some revenge? Yeah, I've been saying I could see Mark Briscoe getting involved and trying to stop MJF from using the Dynamite Diamond Ring. Do they do some sort of shock finish where a Mark Briscoe gets involved and it backfires? And because he gets, you know, Hangman gets disqualified, that's how he loses the title. What a lame fucking way, by the way, for him to lose a championship that would be. I just can't see it. I just can't see it happening. So however it goes down, I got Hangman retaining that title. MJF will live to fight another day. He can cash in that contract some other time. And then this is the match that I think they may possibly be closing the show with. They've certainly done this before with these types of matches. It is unsanctioned. It is a lights out 10-man 5-on-5 steel cage match with Will Ospreay, Darby Allin, Kenny Omega, Kota Ibushi, and the Ace, Hiroshi Tanahashi, taking on Jon Moxley, Claudio Castagnoli, Gabe Kidd, and the Young Bucks. On Dynamite, Ospreay talked about how he wasn't medically cleared to wrestle in this match. But since it's unsanctioned, he knows the risks, and he's wrestling anyway. And obviously, he is medically cleared. That's part of the story. He strongly implied that he was getting neck surgery sometime after this show, and he said if there's a chance that he can't be the same Will Ospreay after Sunday, before doctors take a scalpel to my neck, I'm leaving it all out there. Now, he previously revealed that he has two herniated discs that are pressing on his spinal cord. PW Insider has confirmed, I mean, it seemed pretty obvious, but for the people who just think everything's a fucking work, PW Insider confirmed this is not a work. This is a very legitimate injury, and he is absolutely looking to have neck surgery in the near future. Now, Ospreay spoke to Sports Illustrated this week, and he said, "I am compromised. I've got a few herniated discs pushing against my spinal cord, which is affecting a couple of my nerves. But I can do stuff, and I can perform one last time before I need to go get it all corrected. I got told after All In that I was going to need to rest and take some time off to see how this is going to go. And then the MRIs came back and I got told that this is worse than what we thought it was going to be, but that it's manageable. It's absolutely fine. The surgeon even told me that it's not going to get any worse. It just needs to be corrected." I love how he says in one breath, "I got my MRIs back and it was worse than expected." And then in the next, he says, "It's absolutely fine." Clearly, it's not absolutely fine, but I get what he's saying. It's the Cody Rhodes thing, right? Wrestling with a torn pec inside Hell in a Cell. It can't get any worse. So if you can tolerate the pain, we'll let you wrestle. That was a torn pec, though. These are discs in his neck that are pushing up against his spinal cord. Wrestlers, man, they're a different breed. But he also told CBS Sports that he is terrified of the surgery. He said, "I'm anxious, I'm scared, generally I'm terrified. Not about the match, but just about afterwards. I don't know what it looks like afterwards, because for the first time in my life, I have been disqualified from doing the thing that I love doing. I've never had anybody cut into me, I've never had surgery, I've never broken a bone other than my nose, which everyone can tell because it looks like I've been hit by a frying pan. If I think too much about it, I'll fucking cry. I think humor is honestly the best way I can lighten the mood in this type of situation. For the first time in my life, I have to realize that this is something serious and I don't know how to navigate those emotions." And on the fans being concerned for his safety in the match tomorrow, he said, "I understand they're worried. They hear this type of shit and they're going, this sounds bad. But what people need to remember is that I've been doing this for 10 months now at the highest level. Nobody can tell me that I haven't been doing this at the highest level. I've been working at my best. I know what I'm capable of. I know what I can do. I know what I can't do. Most importantly, the medics know what I can and can't do. The surgeon knows what I can and can't do. And the most important thing is that my safety is utmost guaranteed. I can guarantee my safety in this. I'll make it through. When I heard what the procedure is that I'll be doing, I heard other wrestlers have had this, and they haven't come back the same. So if there's even the smallest chance that I'm not going to be the same after this match and after the surgery, then I need to, for myself, for my pride, I need to go out there and be me. I might have to kiss this part of my high-flying offense goodbye now. It's something that I'm not ready to let go. I'll be honest with you, I'm not ready to let go of that side of me because I think that should be done on my terms. I don't know if that's on the card. So I've got to hope that after this, I can still pick up where I left off. But if not, all the greats have done it. Jushin Thunder Liger's done it. AJ Styles has done it. I call myself the Billy Goat for a reason. I think I can adapt. Look, I trust that he's got people looking out for him. It's bad enough if Swerve ends up needing knee surgery, losing Swerve and Ospreay is going to be a big body blow to the babyface side of that roster. And Ospreay is too important to them to be taking any kind of unnecessary risks. I don't know what this procedure is that he's talking about, if it's some sort of fusion or if it's something less serious. If it's the former, he's gone for a year. If it's the latter, yeah, like kind of what Kurt Angle had done after his WrestleMania match with Brock Lesnar, he could be back in a few months. So it all depends on what type of surgery he ends up getting. I cannot see him getting medically cleared for this if he needs a fucking fusion. So maybe it isn't quite that serious. But even Will Ospreay at 75% is better than a lot of wrestlers at 100%. Now, originally I was going with Team Ospreay for the win. I am changing my prediction. I'm going with the heels to win this match. I just think it makes more sense with Ospreay going in hurt. Tanahashi has the jelly knees. And if the goal is to get a Moxley-Darby match at All Out, then I think the heels should probably go over here. And that's the card, as it stands. There's not a lot about this show that screams Forbidden Door. I would say this is the weakest of all the Forbidden Door shows they've ever done, if you're really into the interpromotional aspect or seeing stars from New Japan and CMLL. Tony Khan did acknowledge that it was challenging putting the card together this year because normally they do these shows before the G1 climax, and this year they ended up doing it right after, so they didn't have access to a lot of those talents, so they had to make the best of a not-so-great situation. It should go back to normal next year with this show in June and All In back in August at Wembley. I don't think there's a need to even do these shows anymore, except that they're going to sell it out with 17,000 people and do one of the biggest gate numbers in the history of the company. So he really doesn't have a good reason to stop doing them until people stop buying tickets. Other news and notes, The Undertaker and Mike Tyson are both in talks to appear on an Indian reality show. Big Boss, hosted by actor-producer Salman Khan, is entering its 19th season and features celebrities living together in a house while being filmed 24 hours a day. Contestants are eliminated through tasks, nominations, and audience votes. According to multiple Indian outlets, including the Times of India, Undertaker is expected to be one of the three wildcard entries this season. The show began filming in Mumbai on Friday, and it is rumored that Undertaker will stay in the house for between 7 and 10 days. So basically, it's like Legends House. Another WWE Hall of Famer, Mike Tyson, has also been rumored as a potential wildcard entrant. Big Boss has not officially confirmed either name. The Great Khali was previously a wildcard entry on the show's fourth season. In 2010, he advanced to the finals before finishing as a runner-up. Man, you know, The Undertaker has been keeping very busy in his retirement. If you would have told me that we would be living in a world where not only is The Undertaker a podcast host, but The Undertaker was apparently helping run the show behind the scenes at Triple Mania in Mexico City last week, and now he might appear on an Indian reality TV show. I would have told you maybe the fake Undertaker would be doing that, but not the real Undertaker, but here we go. Here we are. I don't know if this is actually going to happen or not, but it sounds like conversations are taking place. So he's keeping busy in his retirement. As long as it keeps him out of the ring, then that's fine. There has been yet another update in the death of Hulk Hogan, and this story just took a very dark turn. Hulk's daughter, Brooke, and his former best friend, Bubba the Love Sponge, have been very vocal these last few weeks about the suspicious nature in their view of the circumstances around Hogan's death and their desire to see an autopsy performed before Hulk's wife has him cremated, which still has not happened yet. Brooke has even offered to pay for the autopsy herself. And the results, she says, they don't need to be made public. Whatever they find, they could just keep it private, but they would know then exactly what happened and just be at peace with it. On Wednesday, Brooke took to her Instagram and made a bombshell claim that she has been contacted by people in the know, legitimate phone calls from authorities in the know about her dad's death, that she needs to ask, this is them telling her, you need to ask questions about body camera footage and the 911 tapes from that day. So these are people who could get into serious trouble, she says, if they are outed as sharing this information, but they have told her that those tapes could potentially shed enough light to change the narrative around her father's death. She said she's still being frozen out by Hulk's wife, Skye, from gaining access to any of the materials that she's being told to try to get her hands on. This is what she posted. Here's all I know, she said. So stop speculating and stop asking. I've 100% gotten legit calls from professionals, from police officials to nurses that were supposedly with my dad on the day of his death, telling me that I need to see body cam footage and I need to get a hold of the 911 tapes because they supposedly contain information that could potentially shed enough light to change the narrative that I, and everyone has been hearing. Those same professionals feel so passionately about what they witnessed that they have continued to contact me and push me to find specific answers to this very day. They are quite literally putting their careers at risk because they feel so compelled to do the right thing. I have zero control. I cannot do anything. My hands are tied and I have no say in anything regarding my dad, even as his daughter. Those are the rules that I've been told. I do not have any information on if or when he is being cremated. Could have been right after he died. Could be tomorrow. I don't know. I have been told by my brother that there will be an autopsy. I do not know who will be performing the autopsy. Any information I receive from an autopsy, if one happens, whether I believe it or not, I will be keeping private out of respect for my father. I have to trust that my brother is doing his best to get answers. At the end of the day, answers would be great, but none of it brings my dad back. And my hands are tied. So please stop misquoting, speculating, and asking me if I know anything. I cannot get any information. I know you would think that I could, being his blood, but I can't. We are already dealing with enough. I will not be talking about this mystery anymore. That was on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, TMZ broke the news. Hulk Hogan, cause of death may be medical malpractice. Who remembers that Dustin Rhodes tweet that he posted right after Hogan died? It's a little more eerie now looking back at it. Posted a tweet that he quickly deleted saying that hospitals kill people. They really do. I really mean that. It was something to that effect. This is the TMZ story. Hulk Hogan may have been the victim of medical malpractice. Malpractice that may have cost him his life. This according to sources connected to the death case. Law enforcement sources tell TMZ Sports the Clearwater PD police report regarding the 911 response to Hulk's home the day he died says that an occupational therapist was present at the wrestling legend's Florida residence when he stopped breathing. According to the report, which is on lockdown, the therapist told responding officers Hulk was the victim of medical malpractice. The therapist says during a recent operation, it's unclear if it was the surgery to repair his heart or a neck procedure, the surgeon severed, quote-unquote, severed his phrenic nerve. The phrenic nerve stimulates the diaphragm, which controls breathing. Our sources say Hulk did not have a chest-clenching episode before his passing. Rather, he merely stopped breathing. We're told it was his wife, Skye, who sounded the alarm when his breath halted, and that's when the 911 call was made. We're also told there were conversations among the officers at the scene where they talked about what the therapist had told them, and this is on body cam. It's a fair assumption the conversation between the occupational therapist and the officers is also on body cam. Hulk's daughter Brooke has called for an autopsy. As of a week ago, we were told Hulk's body was not yet cremated, but we have not gotten any clarity if cremation has taken place. Hogan's widow, Skye, later confirmed to TMZ Sports that Hogan's phrenic nerve was compromised during one of his recent surgeries. She added that an autopsy on Hogan has been done, but declined to reveal its results. So unless she changes her mind, we will never know for sure what the autopsy actually revealed. She also said Hogan's body has not yet been cremated. From what I can gather, there's actually two phrenic nerves in the body, a left one and a right one, and they start up in your neck, and they run down through your chest, past your heart and your lungs, and into your diaphragm. They don't say during which surgery this would have happened, assuming he's had multiple surgeries in the last few months. But the one that he originally went in for his neck, was back in mid-May, and he had not been heard from since then or seen on video or anything, which leads me to believe that whatever happened, it happened during that surgery. The Clearwater Police Department later issued the following statement to TMZ. We have been in communication with family members, including his son Nick and daughter Brooke. The unique nature of this case has required us to interview multiple witnesses and seek medical records from a variety of providers, and our detectives continue to do that. All of this takes time. The Hogan family has been appreciative of our efforts and our communication with them. If there was medical malpractice involved, that's going to be one hell of a lawsuit. But this, it just reminds me, you hear malpractice, celebrity, and I know we just had the Matthew Perry death, but it makes me think of Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson's death, which was ruled a homicide due to an overdose of propofol, which is a really powerful anesthetic that's typically used during surgery. Michael Jackson was using it to help himself sleep, the way people take fucking Ambien, which is not its intended usage. And his doctor was convicted and sent to prison for a couple of years. 4 years, but he got out in 2. Any sound off OGs listening to this remember me talking about his death at the time and the media circus around it. I mean, that's some old school sound off right there. This isn't exactly the same thing, but malpractice or negligence, that's a serious thing all the same, you know, especially if it led to someone's death. So I don't know what the autopsy showed or if they intend to pursue this any further. Evidently, there are people directly connected to the situation who wanted his daughter to push for all of these things that she has no power to push for. So if there is something suspicious going on here, and it sure feels that way, it looks like it may end up dying with Hogan. The Hollywood Reporter put out its list ranking the top 10 pro wrestlers turned actors. And there have been many wrestlers that have dipped their toe in the Hollywood pool over the years. Some have been more successful than others. Macho Man Randy Savage will forever be known by a generation of non-fans, as non-wrestling fans, that is, as Bonesaw McGraw from Spider-Man. They're not going to look at him and go, hey, that's the Macho Man. They're going to be like, hey, that's Bonesaw. Whatever happened to that guy? They also used his voice for an episode of Space Ghost. He played Space Ghost's grandfather. But beyond that, you know, he did a bunch of voiceovers and that's about it. Terry Funk, you know, he did Roadhouse and Paradise Alley. Stone Cold, he did a bunch of B-movies like The Condemned and Hunt to Kill, but he also had roles in The Expendables and The Longest Yard. So did Goldberg. He was in The Longest Yard. He was in Santa's Sleigh and that one Universal Soldier movie. Chris Jericho's done some B-level horror movies. MJF right now is going around gloating about being in Happy Gilmore too. There's lots of wrestlers that have been in movies, but who are the best ones? Well, let's see what they had to say, and I'll chime in here with my own. At number 10 on the list, they have Andre the Giant. Andre literally did 2 movies in his life. And one of them, he was in a giant monster suit, and he wasn't even credited in the movie. You never saw his face, and he had no dialogue. That was in Conan the Destroyer. The role that he's most known for is one of my favorite movies of all time. I watched it many, many times when I was younger, The Princess Bride. Andre played Fezzik the Giant, and he was perfect for the role. And honestly, it's such a memorable movie, I would have him up higher on my list. I mean, they have Adam Copeland on their list at number 5. I can honestly say I have never seen a damn thing that Copeland has been in outside of wrestling. I've heard he was good on that Viking show, you know, and he did that other show, Haven. I mean, he could be a great actor for all I know, but there isn't a single thing that he's done in his acting career that is as memorable or that people talk about like they do Andre in The Princess Bride. They have Jesse Ventura at number 9 on their list. Predator is the role he's most known for. Running Man, Demolition Man. He had a small part as a guard. Remember in Batman and Robin? He's not a great actor. I mean, a lot of these guys are not great actors, but he's not a great actor. That's as far as his acting career went, as far as movies. And again, I should point out, like, as we go along here, we're talking movies. We're not really talking TV shows. But I think he went on to do all right for himself. So, yeah, number 9 sounds about right. Number 8 is The Big Show, Paul White. To me, he will always be Captain Insano in The Waterboy. And Giant Santa. Can't forget Giant Santa and Jingle All the Way. Jingle All the Way is a great movie, by the way, if you've never seen it. And I just realized, you know, Schwarzenegger, man, he has shared the screen with a lot of wrestlers, hasn't he? Man, Jesse Ventura, Big Show, Andre, Stone Cold. I remember the Big Show show. That didn't last very long, but that's TV. Then they have Hulk Hogan at number 7. And the author makes the point that without Hulk Hogan in Hollywood first, there would be no Rock or John Cena doing movies. Yes and no. If your point is that Hogan's success in wrestling paved the way for wrestling to become hot the way that it was, and that led to people like Rock and John Cena having the chance to eventually become big stars, like in wrestling, then sure, you could argue that. But the idea that Hogan dabbling in Hollywood and failing is the reason that the door got kicked open for guys like Rock and Cena, I think that's giving him too much credit. You know, Rock was a charismatic guy. I mean, still is, but Rock's a charismatic guy, very successful in wrestling. Hollywood would have come calling for him regardless. Same with John Cena. Same with Roman Reigns right now. Right? You think Street Fighter is the only movie he's going to be in? You don't think he's going to get bigger roles or not get bigger roles in the future? Of course he is. Hogan was doing Suburban Commando and Mr. Nanny, okay? Him doing those movies has little to do with their success. Hogan's biggest role was Thunderlips in Rocky III, which he has always claimed that he was fired for taking the role by Vince McMahon Sr. And Vince told him that you'll never be welcome back if you say yes and do this movie, even though he was already doing jobs on his way out of the territory. It's like it's a Hogan story, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, you know, whether that's actually true or not. I mean, he's told that story for just years and years and years. But it's like the story he's told for years of Hiro Matsuda breaking his ankle on purpose during training when he was trying to become a wrestler. And Matsuda supposedly broke his ankle on purpose to try to run him off. But then when he healed up, right, Hogan valiantly came back. He showed up again and he proved that he was serious about wanting to be a wrestler. Like even Brian Blair, who started his career with Hogan and stayed friends with him for all these years, has said, like, what really happened is that Hogan sprained his ankle by accident one day and he missed a few classes. Like, you know, he ended up spinning it into some heroic comeback story of the evil veteran breaking his ankle. Like, it's just Hogan being Hogan. But like Andre with The Princess Bride, Hogan as Thunderlips, it wasn't just his first movie role, it was his defining movie role. Right? It was his most memorable movie role. No Holds Barred is a guilty pleasure of mine, okay? I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's a great movie. It's not a great movie, but I own the DVD. I've watched it many times. I still enjoy the movie. Suburban Commando is another one. I can go back and enjoy that one, too. And I got a kick out of his cameo in Gremlins, Gremlins 2. Remember, he was sitting in the movie theater at one point. He's in his gear. He's got the bandana on. He's got the winged eagle belt around his waist. He's eating popcorn. And the usher is like, he's got the flashlight. And he's going row by row and he's looking for someone and he finds Hogan and he goes over to Hogan and I'm sorry to bother you, but like we've got gremlins in the projection room. And then Hogan stands up and he turns and he cuts this promo on the gremlins. Like that was great. That was a memorable moment. That was a memorable role for him. Nobody will ever mistake Hulk Hogan for being a master thespian. Him being on this list, yes, he should be on the list. They have him here, what'd they put him at? Number 7, I think? Yes, they have him at number 7. That sounds about right. I would not have him in the top 5. Kevin Nash is number 6. I mean, you talk about legendary roles. Come on now. Super Shredder in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. Unless you grew up during that time, you have no idea how big of a deal Super Shredder was. Like in the movie, he's on screen for 90 seconds and he ends up committing suicide. But he brings that whole, that dock, that wooden dock down on the turtles and he ends up killing himself. Like they're turtles, dude. What did you think was going to happen? But he was the Russian in that Punisher movie with Thomas Jane. He was in The Longest Yard. A lot of wrestlers were. He was in the Magic Mike movies, which I never saw. But I know that was kind of a big deal for a while. And then he did a B-level horror movie, my God. He did this movie called River of Darkness that I saw years ago with Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle is the star. He plays a sheriff in some podunk town. He's killing zombies. Kevin Nash and Psycho Sid play two of the zombies. So if you ever want to see undead Kevin Nash and Sid Vicious in a movie with Kurt Angle, I think Glacier's in that movie too. River of Darkness. I cannot recommend it. I'm not going to sit here and recommend it to you, but that's the name of the movie. And then he did some awful movie about a COVID-19 outbreak or something. I mean, it was a payday, so Nash is not going to say no. Then we get into the top five. Number five is Adam Copeland. Again, I cannot speak to him because I have not seen anything that he has been in. And then we get into the top four. And I agree with their top four. Number four is Rowdy Roddy Piper. Piper did a little movie in 1986 called Body Slam with Dirk Benedict from the A-Team that I very much enjoyed. Piper's tag team partner in the movie is Sam Fatu, the Tonga Kid, who is the father of one Jacob Fatu. After that, he did a movie called Hell Comes to Frogtown, which was terrible. I'm sorry. I know for some people that's a cult classic. It's a terrible movie. And then he did They Live, which is the opposite of terrible. It is a great movie. It has become a cult classic over the years for a reason. I'm a mark anyway for almost anything John Carpenter does. But this became the defining role of Piper's film career, with one of the greatest fight scenes that you will ever see, with him and Keith David. Piper didn't need to film anything else after this. Not It's Always Sunny, nothing. This will forever be what Roddy Piper is known for outside of wrestling. Number three is John Cena. Number two is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And the number one wrestler turned movie star is Dave Bautista. And I agree with that 100%. If this was purely a box office list, then Rock would be number one. Rock would be one. Cena would probably be two. Bautista three. Although Bautista did the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff. Cena would probably be two. And Bautista would be three. So if you're going purely based on box office receipts, then the top three would look a little bit different. But Rock is not a better actor than Bautista. John Cena is not a better actor than Bautista. Bautista has shown more acting range than either one of them. More so than Rock, who plays the same character in almost everything he's in. And I'm not even saying he's bad. I've enjoyed a lot of Rock's films. I mean, I even like Doom. I may be the only one. That movie came out in 2005. I liked it. Walking Tall, Gridiron Gang, Snitch. That doesn't get talked about. Snitch was a good movie. But those were before he really blew up and started doing these big budget blockbusters. But you watch Bautista in a movie like House of the Rising Sun, and then you watch him as Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy, and then you go watch him in Bushwick, and then go watch him in a comedy like Stuber. I went to the theater to see that. And then go watch him in a movie like Knock at the Cabin, which was that M. Night Shyamalan movie. These are all very different roles. And by the way, he was the best part of that Knock at the Cabin movie. He played this character, Leonard. He was great. He's very versatile as an actor. I don't know if any of those three will ever win an Academy Award, but I could totally see Bautista doing some kind of art house type film one day, and that nets him at least a nomination. Although I will say there's chatter that Rock actually might get a nomination, an Oscar nomination for the movie that's coming out, I think in October, he did on Mark Kerr, The Smashing Machine. It's possible. it's possible he could actually get an Oscar nod for that. But like, I could totally see Batista doing an art house type film and then, you know, being nominated for an Academy Award. So I think they nailed it with the top four. You could flip-flop Rock and Cena spots, and I'd be okay with that. But Batista is the best wrestler turned actor. Let's take some mailbag questions. You could always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name or where you are from when you write in. I want to start here with Mike in Binghamton, New York. And this isn't really a question, but it was a nice email that I got and a nice note on Ron Killings as well. Says, first time writing into the mailbag, I stumbled upon your podcast a few years ago and was instantly hooked. I wanted to start off by saying that you are one of the best wrestling media pages in the entire business. I appreciate you covering wrestling like a reporter and not just a fan who shows bias. Your tone and approach should be modeled by others, and it's refreshing to hear someone who not only knows what they're talking about, but also presents this information with news-style analysis. And your interviews are outstanding, not just a fan marking out with talent. Kudos to you and the great work that you do. Mike, that means a lot. It really does. I appreciate that. But he says, I wanted to write up a quick shout out to Ron R-Truth Killings. He did a meet and greet at the Speedy Fest in Binghamton, New York earlier this month. He was genuine and spent so much time talking with fans before absolutely killing it on stage for his music concert. I hope they do a little more with him as a tweener. He's a great character and an even better guy. We've heard all year about John Cena getting his flowers. R-Truth deserves some love too. Keep up the great work. Yeah, R-Truth is great. And you mentioned you look forward to seeing more of him as a tweener, and that doesn't look like it's going to happen. And so that's the shame of it, which is that it looked like they were finally allowing him to take his character in a different direction. And then because they abandoned the John Cena heel turn to wrap that up, it's like, well, we got goofy R-Truth back doing nothing but comedy. And I think there's a lot of potential there that I hope that they can explore, but it's not looking good. But yeah, I mean, look, all the things I've ever heard about R-Truth when he does, you know, appearances, meet and greets and interacts with fans, it's all positive. You know, he's awesome. There's a reason why he has stood the test of time. He is timeless in many ways. He certainly doesn't look his age. I don't know how much longer he intends to do this for, but, you know, he looks like he can go another 20 years if he wants to. So, yes, R-Truth is great. Dane from St. Louis. This is just something I came across. It's a story about Paramount possibly planning to buy Warner Brothers. If this does happen, any thoughts on how this could impact wrestling in the larger sense, given that TKO-owned UFC just signed a multi-billion dollar deal with Paramount and TKO has WWE under its umbrella? First of all, this is just a rumor right now. It is not one that I see as having a lot of legs, at least not yet. Could this be something maybe in a few years? Possibly. But I don't think Paramount is buying Warner Brothers anytime in the near future. I could see why they might want to. You know, if you combine their streaming subscribers, it would make them the number two streamer in the world behind Netflix. Disney is merging Hulu into its Disney Plus service at the end of the year. So if you combine those two subscriber bases, it puts them in the same ballpark, but it's still a little bit less than what Paramount Plus and HBO Max would make up. You've got two movie studios in Paramount and Warner Brothers. I don't know why they need to be merged together into one giant studio, which is what I assume would happen here, because why maintain two separate studios? So I hope this doesn't happen. If it does, how it would affect AEW, since they have a big media rights deal with Warner Brothers Discovery and Paramount is in business with TKO. The honest answer is I don't know, and neither does anyone else. You know, which company would they be acquiring? Because Warner Brothers Discovery is splitting into two companies next year. One for streaming in their movie studio and the other one for their linear networks. So think TNT and TBS. Is it just one or the other, or is it both? If it's both, why even bother splitting them into two companies in the first place? Because AEW is on HBO Max too. So either way, it could affect them, probably not in a good way. But no one really knows. It depends on exactly what's being acquired. But this is where these mergers and these acquisitions can become very messy. It's like, sure, one way to look at it is if streaming services get merged together, that would, in theory, cut down on the number of subscriptions that you would need. like if you're the consumer, but it also creates less competition and fewer options, which is why it might make business sense for these companies. But I don't see all of this consolidation being a good thing for you and me. And we're seeing a lot of it these days. Jose from New York City, do you agree that this year has been the worst year of Triple H's era, and his best era so far has been SummerSlam 2022 all the way to WrestleMania 40? Yes, this year has certainly been the most boring. I will agree with you on that. Christopher from Pensacola, Florida, there have been three men to win King of the Ring, Royal Rumble, and Money in the Bank. Edge, Sheamus, and Brock Lesnar. Buy, sell, and rent on their overall wrestling careers. I'm going to buy on Brock. I feel like that's an easy one. I know Edge has accomplished a lot in his career. Brock's got to be on top. So Brock is who I'm going to buy on. I'm going to rent on Edge, and I'm going to sell on Sheamus. Jordan from Washington, D.C., buy, sell, and rent on who had the best wrestling career out of these three. Jeff Hardy, RVD, and Seth Rollins. That's not really a fair question since two of the three are still active on a regular basis. I mean, I guess from the other question, I guess Brock and Sheamus and Edge are all active too, but I wouldn't necessarily say full time. But like, it's hard to answer questions like this because these people are still active. But as I sit here now, I have to buy on Seth Rollins as having the best career of the three. I'm going to rent on RVD and I'm going to sell on Jeff Hardy, which is going to sound crazy. And there's going to be people who are going to be fucking hanging from the ceiling here trying to jump on top of me for this. Because, look, Jeff is a big star and he's an influential name in the history of the business. No doubt about it. But Jeff is someone who should have been number one on this list. And through his own mistakes, he's not. You know, Jeff is a classic what-if case. If he had his head on straight all those years ago, how far could he have gone? How big of a star truly could he have been? I mean, I'm not saying he would have been John Cena or Roman Reigns. I mean, he could have been so much more. He could have made so much more money. He could have won more championships. He could have been in the Seth Rollins spot, you know, cashing in his Money in the Bank at WrestleMania to win the title, headlining WrestleManias. RVD has had success across multiple promotions. ECW, WWE, TNA. It's won major titles in every single promotion that he's been in, but it's a similar thing to Jeff, where in WWE, one mistake ruined what could have been a legendary run for him. And were it not for politics, you know, back in 2002, he could have been so much bigger than he was. Rollins had some success in Ring of Honor, but he has spent the vast majority of his career in one place. It just so happens that the one place he spent most of his career in is the biggest promotion in the world, and he's conquered the mountaintop there several times over now. And he was part of one of the great factions in WWE history. And if you say the Authority, I'm going to punch you in the mouth. In terms of match quality, I would put his resume up against either RVD or Jeff. I mean, he's had a lot of great classic matches over the years. So it really all depends on what criteria you're going by here. But by all of those key metrics, I have to buy on Seth Rollins. Chris from Bethlehem. I saw a Reels clip from a guy named Tom Green talking about how WCW's PN News got slapped by Rick Rude for stealing money from the locker room, but then also got slapped for bragging about beating Rude in an arm wrestling contest. Was PN News known for stealing money from his fellow wrestlers, or was it that Rude just didn't like him bragging about his arm wrestling win? First of all, I don't believe for a second that PN News beat Rick Rude in an arm wrestling contest, okay? So that's number one. Number two, the story goes that a bunch of wrestlers got money and jewelry stolen out of the locker room. I think it was a European tour that WCW was on, and they accused PN News of being the thief. He has claimed years later that he had his money stolen too. He was also a victim and it wasn't him. I have no idea if he stole the money or not, but I know that if I did steal the money, I would say the same thing that he said. My money was stolen too. That's exactly the sort of thing that a thief would say. So, I mean, who knows? Who knows? You know, for a guy whose claim to fame was the 1 year he spent in WCW in like 1991, I see things pop up about PN News every now and again. He should be happy people remember his name. Kent from Philadelphia. When would have been the correct year and event to do the following dream matches? And he lists a whole bunch of different ones here. I shaved a couple of them off, but I'll run through these real quick. Brock Lesnar against Steve Austin. The correct year to do that would have been 2003. But Austin got hurt. He had to go away. But it would have been around. Had he not gone away, that would have been that year. Shawn Michaels against The Rock. I'm going to also say 2003 when he was Hollywood Rock. I think Hollywood Rock against Shawn Michaels would have been awesome. Or that could have been the WrestleMania match in 2005 had Rock not left. But then, see, then we wouldn't have gotten that Shawn Michaels Kurt Angle classic from WrestleMania 21. So it worked out okay. But I think 2003 or 2005. Sting against The Undertaker. I'm going to say 1998 or 2011. They could have done it in 2011. They didn't. A lot of reasons for that. Either of those 2 years. Goldberg against Steve Austin. 1998. There was no other good year for it. Goldberg came into the WWE literally the night after Austin wrestled his last match. And even if Austin had not wrestled his last match that night, I don't know that Goldberg and Austin in 2003 would have had much appeal, honestly. It was never going to happen in 98, but if you were going to do that match, it would have been 98. Eddie Guerrero against Shawn Michaels. I think a good year to do that would have been 2004. Rey Mysterio against Bret Hart. 1998. Bret Hart against Hulk Hogan, WWF. 1993, obviously. Bret Hart against Hollywood Hogan, WCW. See, I don't look at that as much of a dream match at that point, but if you were going to do it, it should have been 1998. I think they worked a house show match. Actually, it might have been the 98. They worked a house show match together in Los Angeles. I don't remember if Hogan and Bret ever had a singles match on TV. Brock Lesnar against Batista. See, I never saw that as a dream match. But I'm going to say 2014 when Batista came back. Ric Flair against Hulk Hogan, WWF, 1992. And finally, Ultimate Warrior against Bret Hart. That was never going to happen. I don't care what Bret says he was told in his book. I'm not even gonna put a date on it because it was never going to happen and it never should have happened. By the way, I have to say this. Kent didn't leave a name with his email, so I went back to see if he left it on a previous email. And imagine my surprise when I see the last email that I ever got from him was back in 2017, and all it says is, "Thanks for blocking me on Twitter, dickhead. It's okay. Just realize your podcast sucks. Too much internet smark bullshit anyway. Have a nice life, smark." Which just goes to show you that when people leave comments like that on Twitter or on YouTube, or in this case, an email, I always say, more often than not, they're still going to be listening. Or if they stop, they're going to come back. They got to get their fix. This is Exhibit A. He called me a dickhead and said my podcast sucks. But 8 years later, he's still listening. They always do. Kent, no hard feelings, brother. It's all good. I just had to share that, though, because it just made me laugh. I wasn't expecting that. See, I'm like a nicotine addiction. You can't quit me. You can't quit me that easily. Actually, the sound off is the safest addiction you can have. It's much safer than alcohol or tobacco. Keep emailing your questions to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Just remember, the internet never forgets. And Gmail never forgets. Forbidden Door begins at 1 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, and you can catch me live for the review on YouTube at 8 p.m. Eastern. Same for Raw on Monday. That airs on Netflix at 3 p.m. Eastern. I'll be live at 8. And then next weekend, going to plan to get the sound off up a day early as well, episode 927. That'll be on Saturday, because next Sunday is Clash in Paris. So the schedule's a bit up and down for the next week or so, but then we'll be back to normal after that. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great rest of your weekend, and if you're watching, enjoy Forbidden Door, and I will see you on YouTube for the post show tomorrow night. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
On July 21st, with Stephanie Vaquer and Io Sky. And that match ended in a disqualification. Then you fast forward to July 28th, we had Jey Uso against Bronson Reed, which ended in a disqualification. August 4th, you had Seth Rollins one-on-one against LA Knight for the World Heavyweight Championship. In a match that ended in a disqualification. And then we arrived tonight. We had CM Punk and LA Knight against Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed. And wouldn't you know, how did this match end? It ended in a disqualification. As a match, it was fine. It was a good main event until we hit the finish. And then I realized, boy, I feel like I have suffered from deja vu. It almost feels like I've seen this before. It's almost like I'm watching a rerun. Sheamus comes out. He talks about banger after banger. We could talk about DQ after DQ after DQ.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Sala Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Sala Monster.
I love you so long.